So, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thanks.
I thought we would start with a brief meditation, some guided meditation. It should only take 3-4 minutes, but I just thought we could sort of take a deep breath, whatever posture feels comfortable to you, and I'll sort of talk you through this. There are two quotes, but there's also sort of a pause in between the two. So, yeah. Whatever you're comfortable doing, closing your eyes or not. Get your body in a position where you can relax and really take one deep breath and then start. The road and the path. Imagine a familiar road, one that you've driven many times. And as you listen to the quote, find one word or phrase that sort of stands out for you. A road, even the most primitive road, embodies a resistance against the landscape. Its reason is not simply the necessity for movement, but haste. Its wish is to avoid contact with the landscape. It seeks, so far as possible, to go over the country rather than through it. Its aspiration, as we see clearly in the example of our modern freeways, is to be a bridge. Its tendency is to translate place into space in order to traverse it with the least effort. It is destructive, seeking to remove or destroy all obstacles in its way. The primitive road advanced by the destruction of the forest. Modern roads advanced by the destruction of topography. Whether the road you chose was primitive or advanced, it hastens the journey for you. Is there evidence of destruction of the natural and built environment? Do any feelings stir in you upon reflection? Now imagine a familiar path, one that you've walked or run many times. Again, think of one word or phrase as you listen. A path is little more than a habit that comes with the knowledge of a place. It is a sort of ritual of familiarity. As a form, it is a form of contact with the known landscape. It is not destructive. It is the perfect adaptation for experience and familiarity of movement to place. It obeys the natural contours, such as obstacles. As it meets, it goes around. Such obstacles as it meets, it goes around. And what is it that keeps you returning to this path? What do you know about the path's landscape? What experiences do you cherish on that path? And give thanks. Wanted to use that to kind of get us thinking about the land. If we have time later, I'd like to hear maybe some of the roads and paths that came up for you. I did this at the Pyramid Pier, and it was really fun to listen to these places and roads and paths that people had conjured in their minds and why. And so hopefully we'll have some time to do that, or we can stay a little bit late if anybody's wanting to do that. So just wanted to kind of really, really quick review this whole idea of health and this idea of it comes from this family of words that are like holy and heal and wellness and whole with an H and I mean with a WH and just this idea that our complete wholeness and whole health and really won't happen until we've kind of left the planet and are with the Father and with our Creator. But I believe we should be making an effort toward that wholeness. And one of the ways we do that is caring for Earth. And so today, I've entitled this A Profound Resemblance. That comes right out of the paragraphs that we're gonna explore today. So I have these folded just to kind of help you not be distracted by the second paragraph, so we're gonna focus on this first one for a few minutes.
Kind of interesting.
Do you mind sharing?
No, not helping.
There's more than 10.
I heard an interesting thing that I didn't know before. Someone, I can't remember who said it, somebody here said that the word salvation is the same root word as salve, which is healing. So salvation doesn't always mean Jesus Christ Superstar. Sometimes it means healing. And so you can have salvation of the earth, healing of the earth. Perhaps Rio Tinto.
I know, I'm so hoping that... So would someone like to read that first paragraph?
The question of human limits, of the proper definition and place of human beings within the order of creation, finally rests upon our attitude toward our biological existence, the life of the body in this world. What value and respect do we give our bodies? What uses do we have for them? What relation do we see, if any, between body and mind, or body and soul? What connections or responsibilities do we maintain between our bodies and the earth? These are religious questions, obviously, for our bodies are part of the creation, and they involve us in all the issues of mystery.
Thanks. So I want to just ask two questions, and the first one is more about our culture. I want to kind of hear what people think our culture's attitude is toward this, that first question or sentence about our attitude toward biological existence and the life of the body in this world. It sounds kind of lofty, but what are your thoughts on that? What do you see in your culture? I mean, our cultures vary among the, even throughout the states. I mean, my Southern California culture is very different than this culture up here. There are similarities and overlapping, elements, but it's different. So I'm just curious about where people are coming from and what they see in this regards.
One of the things that comes to mind when I'm thinking of that phrase, our attitude towards our biological existence. Earlier this summer, we had someone talk about green burial, and I never thought of this, but we take our bodies, and when we bury them, we put them in a vault to protect them from, we take a dead body and wall it off from creation. And so just thinking of the implications of what that says about our culture and our relationship to our body and our relationship to the rest of creation in connection with our body and walling ourselves off to that. And I don't know, anyway,
yeah,
so
that's interesting.
One of the things that I thought of was our attitude towards our biological existence. I think sometimes we want to deny that in some ways, or
but I think we don't talk about death. If you ever want to kill a conversation, dying, subject to death, everybody leaves and nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
So.
I'll see you later.
So I think in a lot of ways we live our lives denying that we are mortal, or trying to live forever, or be young forever, whatever, we want to.
Yeah. Maybe we can take that to the idea that we're constantly trying to prolong our lives, and it's not always a better health quality or even a good quality of life that we're, and this is where my conflict with public health is. That's what I got my degrees in, and I don't necessarily believe in prolonging and just managing disease for decades. And so, you can probably speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
I'm not saying, across the board, but I think we've taken it to an extreme that we're in denial that we should live till we're, yeah.
Well, I'm a massage therapist, and I would say I have, the majority of people who come to me are people who want to know more about their body and integrate their physical and spiritual self, and they come in and talk about death, and they come in, and I think that people, even though there's the popular culture part, that people have this need, and when they find places that they can get it satisfied, that they're drawn to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the options that's never presented to us when we go to the doctor is the option to say no. And I think people need to, or the medical community needs to listen to that option and understand that people do have the option to say no. However, it's not met very well, because when my mother was dying of cancer, she told them she didn't want any more treatment, and she was dropped like a hot potato. I could not believe how quickly she was dropped. Just, that was it.
And where was that?
What do you mean by dropped?
The oncologist just said, well, I don't need to see you anymore then.
And didn't arrange for any palliative care?
Well, the fact was she liked the oncologist. And even though she determined she didn't want any further treatment, I was very shocked that the oncologist would not continue with her. Mm-hmm. That she was, I mean, she was totally just, that was it. Mm-hmm. Cut and dried, that was it. Mm-hmm.
So I worked for some oncologists on the medical floor, and it was really interesting that one of the oncologists, the older one actually, had a harder time with patients who were refusing to keep going. And he actually asked me to try to convince somebody, and I said, there is no way I'm ever going to try to do that, because it's their choice. And I would always tell them, you write down every single question you have, and you make sure that doctor sits there until he answers them all, or then you make some other choices and stuff like that. But then the younger ones were a little bit more broad in their understanding of that it's not just treating oncology. We're not just treating cancer, we're treating the whole patient. And the thing I was thinking about is that I think the way I was raised with the body and even with the earth wasn't something to subdue and control. And I think that bubbles over into healthcare with disease, is to control and subdue it or to whatever, and that's not biblical at all.
Even diet and exercise, I think the idea of subduing the body is the big goal. I mean, the thing you had yesterday about the food thing, I think, speaks to that. And we have that same, we have in some ways the same ideas about our body as we do about creation. Like you said, that it's to subdue it and control it. And
I was reading a story, I don't know, sometime in the recent past, and it was a Southern author, and she was talking about how she had been raised about her body, and basically her body was a tool, you know, to attract a mate. And I was thinking that I don't think my upbringing was that much different from that, you know, that it was, you know, my body was a means to an end, whatever the, you know, the end might be, but
Three things. First of all, you notice how many times she said the word subdue it. Talking about the I thou, I it, the objectification of the other, it is a thing, number one. Number two, you mentioned about, you know, our general culture, you know, there is not one statement that's been given here yet that I could not link to the corporatization of our culture here in North America, where everything is for profit, and if that body is no longer going to be making me money, It is not an I, thou. This is my mother. How can I help this person through the transition? It is an I, it. I mean, the number of dollars that are made in the last 10, 15 years of life are astronomical. And so I think the thinking of the ways of Christ, the ways of, you know, our community of faith, how we are to view our bodies and to treat our bodies, and the way the dominant corporate monetized culture that dominates all of this. And it just, to me, it enhances the contrast of the teachings of Jesus and life in the kingdom of God and life in the world. And it's truly an amazing contrast.
Well, and I don't want to demonize that oncologist, that one who tried to convince. He was an amazing oncologist. But the thing that was interesting about him was I think he was really scared of death. Yeah. He was afraid of failure. But that meant failure to him.
Right, but this
not
is,
just the bottom
yeah.
line, but I think it was also,
right.
there was a, I didn't save her.
Right, but how many
yeah.
times do we go through Lent and Easter? I mean, we talk about death in the Christian church. It is part
Here,
of,
yeah.
you know, so when my father, a Lutheran pastor, is dying, he dies with a smile on his face in the story of his life and the story that he adopted as, this is what my narrative of my life is about, based on faith. He's gone someplace.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the terror of what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
What am I about to make? Deny, deny, deny.
Yeah.
And this is all part of the gospel, the good news.
Yeah.
There is another story to live
exactly.
by.
Yeah.
And that gives us a joy.
Yeah.
Which we may be complete fools, but I'd rather be there than, you know.
Yeah.
Fighting it tooth and nail.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. It's working with nature, small m, but it's also working with the great sea, the creator God.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
that's, it's an amazing story, and it is a gospel. It is a good news.
Yeah.
As opposed to the good news of the earth, which is, of the world, which is, the more stuff you can accumulate, the better.
Right.
You guys are the most great.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an immaturity in our culture, right, though. So you think of, like, you know, what we all accept as the adolescent attitude of I am impenetrable and I am, you know, nothing can hurt me, and I, you know, and there's some biochemical things behind that, but I think that culturally, you know, I've seen a lot of other cultures where the kids are a lot more in touch with that death aspect and the rituals and the rites of passage and there are other rites of passage along the way that kind of leads that up as a logical step. And so it almost feels like we kind of, with our attitude towards death, just that part of our maturity as a culture sticks in the adolescence
yeah,
phase.
Yeah.
I mean, that also shows in our foods. I mean, who of you have seen a creature, not to mention a plant, that is just killed in front of your eyes, and then skinned, and then quartered, and then let to hang for a while,
yeah.
and then you're going to eat? I mean, if we were to show these films to the children, we'd be in jail because they're practically pornographic. But that's what we do. We eat meat, and there is death. But that segment of death in our food system is so out of sight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like old age.
We eat hamburger. We don't eat cows.
We eat bacon, not bacon.
So, yeah.
Pigs are cute.
I'm sorry. That's okay. I think part of that slaughter stuff is the fact that the sacredness has been removed from it. And
No, it's I it. You know, there are half dozen, believe it or not, major slaughterhouses in America. Used to be different, and that's exactly it. These are its. They are things.
You know, when you think about Native Americans and other cultures
right.
like that, they
exactly.
are sacred
exactly.
about that, and that sacredness
right.
is
that's
now turned into money.
That's right.
But the other thing I wanted to go back to, too, is when a loved one has chosen to deny and not have any more health, you know, measures and to begin this journey, there's a whole lot of other people connected to that one person
mm-hmm.
who won't allow that person to take that journey. They're constantly at them to, let me take you out, you did this, I'm gonna do this. So we as family members and caretakers have to step back and respect this person's decision to make this journey their own. And I think that's sometimes lost in our culture because a person is weaker, they can't really, you know,
fight this physically or emotionally. And when they've decided to take this journey, oftentimes others have ripped that decision from them. So I think we all need to learn to look at that loving as hard as it is and respect the choice that they've made.
Yeah.
Because it's their journey, not mine.
Gina, let's take one more comment, and I want to ask that second question before I move on to the next chapter.
Well, I have a couple things, and one is kind of stepping out on a limb. I have a hard time with this kind of discussion because there are more and more people actually doing permaculture, doing raising and slaughtering in a very humane way. There are these huge movements going on, and I think if we can start feeding what we like instead of railing against what we don't like, that we're going to make a bigger difference in the world. And my mother in 1978 made the decision, which I had a hard time with at the time, but not to get any medical, regular medical treatment. She did acupuncture, Chinese medicine, and went to a naturopath. And she lived 12 years with breast cancer, which is more than double the number of years that the expected survival rate was using chemotherapy and an operation. So she proved to me that she made the right choice, and she died at home and you know, surrounded by flowers. And so these things are, there is support for these things. It may not be the oncologists who haven't trained in that, but
no.
It might be.
Yeah.
But there are
exactly.
Chinese doctors,
mm-hmm.
and there are naturopaths, and there are acupuncturists who do work with people in these circumstances and are open to that. So anyway, that's my 50 cents.
That's a different expression of our culture based on this particular comment that we're looking at. So thanks for bringing that up. So I do want to ask the question, what connections or responsibilities do we maintain personally between our bodies and the earth? And we've gotten great comments on our culture and other cultures even, but anybody willing to take it a little more personal? And
can you repeat the question?
Yeah, it says.
Oh, sorry. I didn't see that.
I can find it faster because I underlined it.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
You got it? Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, and I'm not sure of your name in the back who just commented. Sorry.
Ruth.
I mean, I can tell you're doing, like, what you're talking about is a great example of that, and not just the massage therapy, but I think you probably have other examples you could share, but yeah, so.
My favorite things to do pretty much in the world are take my dogs for walks and garden, you know, and they both are seem kind of holistic, but they recognize a continuum of life energy.
There's an ancient Roman author, which was quoted actually by my favorite vocal pedagogue or voice teacher, and it is this: life consists in learning to live in harmony with nature. And when one sees and lives by the narrative that we are connected, we are deeply, deeply connected with God's creation, physically, the working out of that in life, joining with other systems, with other groups that are seeking to be therapeutic and organic and all the rest of the, you know, things that we could and should be doing if we want to live our values. But that deal about understanding that in the narrative by which we live, linked to the gospel, we are deeply connected to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps God so loved the world includes not just people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John 3:16, in case
mm-hmm.
of this.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the journey I'm kind of on has to do with between that body and the creation respect, especially recently reading Barbara Kingsolver.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that comment of thinking of how I nourish my body, but then what's the impact that nourishment has to get to me, you know, if it's, whereas, you know, if I grew up in my backyard, then I I kind of have a very distinct knowledge of the impact. It's actually the fact that I'm growing that and consuming that actually benefits even the soil, whereas there's so many other ways to get nourishment into my body that aren't as respectful of the earth, and they tend to subject and subdue it, like the comment earlier, more than live with it. So it's a journey that I'm on.
Something.
Well, I was just going to say that as I've done permaculture gardening over the last 5 years or so, that I realized, I don't know where we went in history where we started plowing and doing these other things, but when you do permaculture, you know, I used to do those complicated, you try to rotate and go through the flower and the root and the, you know, all the different stages, so you're rotating your vegetables around, and as I do permaculture, I realized, you know, one plant does all those things. And, you know, God really created things in a way that actually works. And we can work with how it was already given and actually produce more than if we're buying seeds from the seed company and tilling. And it's amazing how seeds grown in an area grow better than the ones you buy from the seed company that were grown someplace else. But there's the basic thing being, if we watch how God actually created things and work with that instead of trying to subdue it, we actually get way more production.
Yeah.
We went wrong like a long time ago.
And you know what, though? It uses that word in Genesis 1. I think I want to sit down and meet with Kent and ask him what did that mean? What Hebrew word were they using? Because it does say, here's, I've given this to you, so do it and have dominion over it. And I don't think necessarily that those have to be. I'm stretching here. I'm trying to figure out. He couldn't have mean, you know, exploit it.
Desecrate.
Yeah.
Subdue. So I
think the other thing, though, I mean, that's one verse.
Mm-hmm.
You back up to the Genesis 1. It's the garden, take care of, you know, there's a
mm-hmm.
stewardship element there.
Mm-hmm.
I planted this garden
yes.
for you to care for. And I think, so you can always take one verse and either out of context or say this one verse. And so I think you got to look at kind of the breadth of Scripture and not all of it says destroy and dominate and subdue.
Yeah.
And whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and we have to realize that when we're looking at our definition of what subdue
right.
or dominate
this is what
means.
I'm curious.
Yeah. And our definition
of it. We're thinking of arctics and bulldozers and where you can completely flatten the ground.
Do you know what the Hebrew word would have been? Not.
Well,
I tend to argue semantically when I get in an argument. And so words are really important to me.
I would address it is, you know, Genesis 1 talks about God created this and he said it was good.
Yeah.
You know, and so put yourself, okay, you create whatever, a house, a garden, and you give it to someone to live in or to take care of, and
right.
they go through and plow it with a bulldozer, are you going to be happy?
Right.
Probably not.
Yeah.
No. So why would God be happy that we're destroying this creation?
Yeah. Let's look at the second paragraph. Someone want to read that one for us?
But the questions are also agricultural, for no matter how urban our life, our bodies live by farming. We come from the earth and return to it, and so we live in agriculture as we live in flesh. While we live, our bodies are moving particles of the earth, joined, how do you say that word?
Oh, you know what? There's a type I spoke
inextricably.
Inextricably, both the soil and to the bodies of other living creatures. It is hardly surprising, then, that there should be some profound resemblances between our treatment of our bodies and our treatment of the earth.
And clearly I feel a little like I'm speaking to the choir here, preaching to the choir, as they say. We've answered some of the questions I wanted to ask. It kind of came up in our discussion. And Ruth, kind of like what you said about not focusing on what's not happening. I kind of chose to, if we were going to talk about food systems, to kind of move off the conventional food system for today. But the garden thing keeps coming up, which I'm really glad, because that's kind of how I prepared to talk through the rest of this. And I think there is something important that happens when we prepare soil and we plant and we tend to the garden. And I'm going to make a suggestion, an observation, and a probability. And I don't know if any of you have read Animal Vegetable Miracle, Barbara Kingsolver. That was a life-changing book for me too, and along with this collection of essays by Littleberry. So these three things actually came from her husband, who included articles in the book. Some of them were very politically driven, but he focused on the two food systems. And this suggestion about conscience, keeping conscious about agriculture in your body, and rather than relegating the task to experts in agribusiness. And then an observation about convenience. Actually, this is from me, not from Stephen Hawk. Something is lost if things are too easily acquired, and our souls are nurtured when we have a part in the growing process. And then a probability about exploitation from Stephen L. Hawk. The most humane way to feed others is local farmers providing food for their community. Any thoughts on any of those?
There's something that's screaming in me about social justice with respect to all that too. About social justice. We can sit here in this room, all of us relatively privileged. Mm-hmm. We could choose to use the time to use our land to garden if we want to. Or maybe we've got cars and we can drive to the community garden. Maybe we live in an area that's got enough urbanization where we get a community garden. We can walk to it if we're really fortunate. Mm-hmm. I just think about that video that we saw about the food to table. What was that one called?
A Place at the Table.
Mm-hmm. Where there are so many people that are be thankful to eat the GMO corn and mm-hmm. the, you know, whatever they can get on food stamps. And even when they finally get a job, they can't afford to get to the market to get the good food, the whole foods. I just feel really, really privileged to be able to be part of this conversation, and really sad for the people that can't be. I feel like we need to speak out against that.
I kind of go the other way again, because Seattle just started a 6-acre food, now I can't remember what they're calling it, but it's basically a 6-acre, it's got orchards and a ton of food plants that anyone can go harvest. And there are plots all over Seattle that have food donated to food banks. And then there's, I don't know, I think it's Portland, there's other places that have things that helping people grow their own food,
right,
who are poor,
urban
and finding the
everywhere.
Smallest
mm-hmm.
places to help them grow it. And again, that's where I want to put my effort. Not getting angry at what is. It's like, how do we come up from the bottom and change what is? How do we help? What do we do to change it?
I appreciate your comment though, Penny, because I mean, if you're a single mom and you're just doing
how much time do you have?
How much
time do you have to go get it?
I mean, I think it's always good for all of us. I mean, just being here is usually an indication that we come from fairly privileged backgrounds, you know, to recognize that there's, I mean, not always, but yeah. I think that there can be kind of a, you know, almost a grandiosity about doing it the right way. And sometimes people really just, that's so far beyond what they can get to.
The thing that I think, though, that I think it's kind of a combination of the both is that I know in Colville, where I was living before I came up here, 4,000 people, lots of people using the food bank. But the food bank got a lot of their food from local gardens,
mm-hmm.
local farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lutheran Church even came in, and they brought in a whole bunch of really healthy food, and the people went through, and they got,
mm-hmm.
you know, a whole bunch of... And so I guess I feel like it's a... it's something to really be aware of, mm-hmm. and that there's communities that are responding to it, and local farmers that are contributing to food
sure.
banks.
I love things like that, like gleaning and stuff like that, where they
yeah.
get a group of people together, you go gleaning and bring it to the food bank. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic
right.
use of resources.
And there's more and more people that I think are aware of it and participating
mm-hmm.
in that, and yeah.
There's a group in Central California called Gleanings for the Hungry, and they take all the discards from local farmers, things that they can't sell because they're just not perfect, or they're damaged but they're still edible, and they dehydrate all these
mm-hmm.
fruits and vegetables, and then they ship them to developing countries mostly. But I love the idea of that. It's taking
mm-hmm.
what is going to be thrown away and not throwing away.
Mm-hmm.
Inner city Detroit, the out-of-work auto workers started a co-op greenhouse, and they're now selling, there were no vegetables in the city of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
And so now there's these co-op greenhouses run by out-of-work auto workers, and they've started cottage gardens all over the city. And everybody hears the ugly things about Detroit. They don't
yeah.
hear things like that.
My sense of it is that all these things that we're talking about, these you know, urban gardens, food banks, food stamps, they're not really getting at the root, any of these are getting at the root problem. And I think the root problem is culturally, societally, we need a realignment of our values. If our values really are going to be living in peace with the earth, living in a way that we can all have adequate, healthy, nutritious food, and we don't need to have these other systems in place, that takes a radical realignment of where we place our values as a society. And I think that, I don't have a, you know, there's obviously no easy way to do that, but I think we have to think in pragmatic terms. I think as we look in the history of humanity, people think in a fairly similar fashion throughout history. Of we can't rely on people necessarily doing things in the interest of everyone. I think innately we are somewhat selfish in that sense. And so I think for me it's how do we set up the incentives so that the incentive is to realign our society towards these cultures. And I have a feeling that that's where the church can come in and play a role of saying that our incentive is that we know that collectively when we are together on something, we draw spiritual strength from that. And that's an incentive and a value that we have. So I think that that's a place where we as a church can have a voice here. And I think it's important to do that in a really, as I said, a pragmatic sense of understanding how humans think and how we would all, how we all kind of think in a somewhat selfish sense, whether that's for myself or my family or the people who think and look like me. But let's use that to our advantage as we try to twist the cultural incentives to this realignment.
But give a concrete example. I mean, you say, I think some of the things that are happening right now are making a huge difference. I mean, if you talk to inner city Detroit people, I think they would argue with you. But so what concrete thing, I mean, you're saying this different attitude, but how are you actually going to make the changes? I mean, it's nice to talk about, but.
Sure. I mean, as our urban farms, I'm not sure that people are getting, okay. I struggle to come up with a concrete answer, but my point is, we know how we think as people, we know how we, I think my answer then is, okay, let's use our power in this, the way the rules are set up in our country, is we can use our collective voices in government to change laws in that way. And I hear that, and I understand that that's not a straightforward, perfect thing, and maybe that brings up another discussion, but.
Well, if you look at that, because if you look at that movie Penny brought up, Place at the Table, during the Nixon presidency, hunger was essentially eliminated in America. Everybody had food and access to food.
Jason?
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you repeat
that? We should see that moving in.
Since that
place at the tables of the
And then when Reagan came in, he cut everything. And we've continued to do that over and over again. And so, you know, the food banks in America went from like 40 food banks to over 400,000 food banks or something like that. And we're still, people still don't have food. You know, so we've shifted this providing food or at least a basic safety net from government taking care of it through government programs like food stamps or feeding, you know, feeding kids at school.
To nonprofits.
To the churches and nonprofits, and they're not keeping up.
Or I think having a sense of, let's look at, so if we're going to say we want to encourage small-scale farmers, we want to encourage urban farms, we want to encourage these different things, then we're looking at looking at that in contrast to kind of industrial agriculture, that runs on huge government subsidies for the big five crops. So having a sense of where that money is going, what's that doing, and then being vocal about that to the point of, I mean, there's lots of strategies for dealing with that. I think a great one that worked effectively in South Africa is deinvestment, saying we are not going to support organizations that put money into Monsanto, into these other companies. And and I think part of that is a learning process for the culture, saying, look at how we're all these things, we have all these different portfolios, all this money in this different area. So having a greater understanding of that is a place to start.
Yeah, and I just want to let you know, you're welcome to go past dinner, but if they would like to stay, I'd like to hear more comments and then maybe have a closing.
Just similar to what Ruth was saying, back in 2009, I came across a documentary called Fierce Light. And basically, I would suggest you see this. It's a marvelous documentary. It's about the movement of movements, Ruth, occurring around the world about groups who are coming together, the movement of movements, to rebalance our relationship, in this case, wholeness or wellness with our food and our attitude toward food. And one of the things I've learned in the last few years is that a dollar is a vote. And it is a vote for a system. And if you're voting for local, organic, or whatever you can, move, at least this is how I think it. So when I'm voting,
you're at the farmer's market versus if you're at Walmart.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not just buying an object. I'm supporting a system. I'm voting.
That's the choice that, to Penny's point earlier, we in this room have that ability to.
That is exactly. And that is.
The people who are paid minimum wage that don't have a sustainable, but they have to shop at Walmart.
That's right. Systems change. Well, they don't actually. If you watch the dark, is Walmart good for America? The answer is a definite no. That is the high cost of low prices.
I'm hanging though at that bottom level of Maslow's hierarchy, and I just I have to eat.
Yeah, right.
Where's
where my kids?
You know,
and they've been convinced that they're going to get a better.
The discussion we have today, the discussion we're having today is not relevant to that person in that spot, but it's very relevant to us as a society that we have that seat at the table to influence the systems.
You vote with your dollars. You vote with your values. And those dollars make an impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to Ruth's question earlier, to me, I thought of an example. In Seattle, there was a movement to get. So, if you're familiar with food stamps, it's a card, a debit card usually, and you can only spend that at certain places. And oftentimes, that's not at farmers markets. And so, there was a push in Seattle to get that account in Washington State, and now it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to
So that is changing the system.
And I don't. Yeah. I think that there's a limit. Yeah. There's some limits there, but that's an example of how people in this room can have an impact on people who are not in this room. I'm saying we want you to have that choice, and there's a lot of things that go into that. But I think that's an example of that.
Yeah. And this was meant for us. This wasn't meant tonight, but I appreciate the. Being very aware that other people don't have the option, as many options for choice. But really, I just want us to come away with a greater awareness and maybe thinking about how we can do things a little bit differently to live more responsibly on the planet. So yeah, I appreciate everybody. It's a great conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.